Good evening and welcome behind the news for July 7, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Got two, the usual two segments lined up for tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll talk with Laura Carlson, who is with the Interhemispheric Resource Center based in Mexico City, about what's going on with the Zapatistas. They've been issuing a strange series of communiques about major steps, declaring states of emergency, but it's all kind of mysterious. So we'll get her view of what's going on down there in southern Mexico. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Bill Fletcher, who is now heading up Trans-Africa, but also spent a little over 5 years working at the AFL-CIO as their education director, and we can talk. We're going to talk to him about both Africa in the news, the G8 summit. I was just reading in the New York Times the other day that George Bush has done more for Africa than any other president, which seemed kind of surprising to me. But we'll ask Bill what that's about, and also maybe talk to him about what's going on with the potential split in the AFL-CIO. But before we get to that, some words about the economic headlines. First of all, the usual Thursday morning release of initial jobless claims. That is, people who've lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits. That rising 7,000 last week. But the four-week moving average, which smooths out some of the volatility in that measure, falling a couple of thousand. It's now kind of at the lower end of the range it's been bouncing around between for the last year or so, and signifies a decent but not great job market. And I suspect that's what we're going to see out of tomorrow morning's employment report for June. Decent but hardly great. The ABC Washington Post weekly measure of consumer attitudes, their consumer comfort index, rose 2 points last week to -9, which is it's been its average ever since the thing's existed for the last 20 or so years. It's been had an improving trend through May and early June, and then has since kind of stalled out. But it does seem, at least according to chain store sales, which are released also today, that Americans are spending money pretty aggressively. Two of the measures from the Institute for Supply Management, that's a trade association of purchasing managers, the people who purchase things for corporations, and they're presumably in good touch with the state of business at their employers. The ISM's survey of manufacturing purchasing managers rising by a couple of points to 53.8. Anything above 50 signifies an expanding sector. It had been falling for pretty close to a year, this increase is kind of welcome, since the manufacturing sector has been looking a little dodgy of late. But now it does seem to be, at least its slide has been slowing. But that also means that the Federal Reserve is also less likely to stay its tightening hand, since the Fed rarely ceases tightening until the ISM index goes under 50. That's not a cause and effect. It's just something we've noticed over throughout history. But it does seem that the Federal Reserve will continue pushing up interest rates for many more months until they're satisfied with the things. The ISM service sector index, their non-manufacturing index, rose sharply in June from 58 to 62. So that's been bouncing around roughly between those 58 and 64 levels for the last year or so, but it does signify a pretty strong service sector. Stronger than what most analysts were expecting, by the way. And then the Mortgage Bankers Association's tally of weekly applications for new mortgages up strongly last week. Both the new purchase and the refinancing components were up sharply. Refinancing has been very important over the last couple of years, as people have been taking out a lot of cash as they've been refinancing their mortgages, and that cash withdrawal has prompted a lot of consumer spending, and those are still quite in strong shape. And now, as promised, a few words about the state of the housing market in the U.S., which is something of a bubble, and it does seem that perception has taken off in the last couple of months. Sometime in the middle of May, I did a search of the Nexus newspaper database and found out that the phrase housing bubble was not appearing about once or twice a day in our major newspapers. But starting in the middle of May, it's really, really taken off. So there's a lot of concern about the housing bubble. And certainly it's not just the United States that's been experiencing one. up, according to The Economist, the U.S. is up 73%, its average house price since 1997. Not very little compared to Spain's 145, Ireland's 192, and South Africa's 244. At least until very recently, most of the talk about the housing market has been pretty reassuring. Money Magazine has a special issue on it, but it's mostly reassuring. Alan Greenspan, who spent much of the late 90s denying the existence of a stock bubble, has spent much of the last couple of years denying that housing was getting a little pumped up. And historically, that nominal house prices have rarely fallen, and certainly not by very much. This is supposed to be comforting, that house prices have rarely fallen in our history, and they haven't since the 1930s, if you don't adjust for inflation. Back in the beginning of June, Greenspan did say that there are some signs of froth in local markets. Froth, of course, as every beer drinker knows, is a collection of tiny bubbles, but Greenspan shied away from that word, but he did finally say that there is a little froth in the housing market. But he said he's not likely to have, if it comes to an end, it's not likely to have substantial economic implications. Well, it's certainly true, as Greenspan says, that house prices have rarely fallen in the United States since the 1930s, and they did fall pretty hard in the 1930s, but that's only if you don't adjust for inflation. If you do adjust for inflation, they've taken steep dips in the 1970s, late 1980s, and several times in the 1950s. So we have had the longest uptrend in the housing market in modern history for the last, it really hasn't been a substantial downtrend since the late 1980s. Also, the residential construction share of GDP is at very, very close to record levels, and it too has been rising steadily for the better part of the last 15, 20 years. So it's been quite a remarkable upsurge, and even if you look at house prices next to incomes as a way of measuring just how expensive or cheap housing is, that measure, comparing average house prices to average household incomes, is at record highs as well. Very, very high valuations in houses. And as I said earlier, people have been borrowing very heavily against that housing appreciation. Goldman Sachs estimates that since over the last 4 years, U.S. households extracted some $2 trillion in borrowing against the value of their housing, home equity loans, second mortgages, and all sorts of other creative instruments. That's more than the increase in personal income over the same period. So what's really been driving consumption throughout this strange economy we've been through over the last 4 or 5 years has been what the professionals called mortgage equity withdrawal. People have been borrowing much more aggressively and creatively. About a third of all new mortgages at adjustable rates, even though interest rates are very low and more likely to be adjusted up than down. People have been doing these very no down payment mortgages. They've been doing mortgages that don't even, whose early payments don't even cover the interest. So with each additional month, you're getting deeper in the hole. These are called negative amortization mortgages, which is a fancy word for something absolutely crazy. So the consequence of this will be very interesting. Some optimists have been taking comfort from the fact that the housing bubble in bubbles in Australia and Britain have not resulted in any kind of price, a collapse in prices, just a flattening out of prices. But even under those averages, some of the more marginal properties have been declining rather sharply in value. And the story is not over yet. Japan had a tremendous housing bubble in the 1980s, and their prices collapsed and are still declining. So the optimists say that flattening is what's in our future. The pessimists say a collapse is in our future. In any case, it's likely to slow down the economy. Even a flattening is likely to slow down the economy, and the decline could be very, very serious. So this bears further watching in the future, but it's almost as if we haven't really worked through all the consequences of the collapse of the stock market bubble, and it's sort of lived on again through the housing market. So let's see if that finally comes to an end. And since I gassed on a little longer than I thought, I'll skip the musical break and just go straight on to Laura Carlson, who is waiting on the line from Mexico City. Welcome to WBAI, Laura Carlson.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here.
And I'm sorry, you're with the Interhemispheric Resource Center?
Yes, we recently changed names, and we're still the IRC, but it's the International Relations Center.
International Relations Center, okay. And you've been based in Mexico City for pretty close to 20 years, right?
Yes, I've been here since then, and the organization is based in New Mexico.
Okay, so some strange communiques have been emerging from the Zapatistas' jungle hideout. I read one the other day that was all about major steps are about to be taken, declarations of a state of emergency, but not much more substance than that. What's going on down in the jungles of southern Mexico?
Well, this all started out on June 19th. It came out June 20th. There was a red alert declared by the Zapatistas. This caused a lot of alarm in Mexico and beyond the organizations that have been close to the Zapatistas, because nobody really knew what it was about. And there were certain alarming measures that were being announced, like closing down the administrative buildings of the good government boards. The leadership was prepared to be replaced, and they were withdrawing solidarity workers from the area. We knew that there were two events that had happened then that were disturbing. One was that the government announced that it had found marijuana fields in areas of Zapatista influence, when in fact these areas were not even part of where the communities are. And another one was that a bank closed down the account where they received international solidarity funds, claiming that it was linked to money laundering, a claim that they later had to retract. But more than this, we really didn't know what was behind the red alert and why such a dramatic an announcement was being issued. Then the next day, there was another communique saying that this was basically preventive, and it assuaged fears because it also said that there would be no offensive military action on the part of the Zapatistas, and that basically what they were doing is they were going to carry out a consultation with their troops and the base communities, and they just wanted to make sure that they were prepared in case there was any attack from the government at that time. Well, the next thing they did was carry out the consultation, and they announced what you mentioned before, that 98% of the people in Chiapas, in the organization, had decided to take the next step.
Now,
and
before you
knew what the next step was.
Before you go on, though, 98%, it's kind of, it almost sounds like a Saddam Hussein election, 98%. It's hard to get 98% of any group to agree on anything. Is that a credible number?
Well, yeah, I think part of it has to do that this next step was, in fact, so vague. Essentially, then the next step was declared in the declaration, but that was the figure that came out. And they expressed gratitude to civil society and to everyone who had been supporting them up to them, and declared kind of a new stage in the movement by saying that anyone who believed in what they were going to do from now on should stay with them, and anybody else was politely excused.
So who is this referring to? Who is excused?
This refers to anyone who supported the movement up to now. I think basically it was a way of saying, we're going to do something new now, and we want everyone to reconsider their support of the movement and to decide if they're going to continue to be with us or if they're going to part ways.
And do we still have not much idea of what this something new is exactly?
Well, now we do have pretty much of an idea, because the sixth declaration of the Lacandon jungle came out. Now, the declarations, the first one was proclaimed when the uprising began in 1994, and they tend to be statements of position, much more formal than many of the communiques that come out of the Zapatista, of the ECLN, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. So in this declaration, although it still doesn't have a lot of details, we do know where they're going. Basically, it starts with the history of the organization, the training, the uprising, and how it was concentrated on indigenous demands, how it established links with civil society, which in this case is the Mexican public mostly, and how they reached a point of decision when the San Andres Accords that were signed with the government were rejected in the Mexican Congress. And that was a point when the movement decided not to work with making demands on the government any longer, that they really lost hope of anything coming from the government, and they began to consolidate self-government in the communities. with this declaration, they're saying they've reached a sort of a political plateau in that second stage of consolidated self-government. They recognize their progress in that, but they've realized, they say, that the government was not giving in on their demands for rights. And they also make a very profound critique of the economic model, particularly the neoliberalism, as they call it, that they say is threatening not only them in Chiapas, but huge sectors of the Mexican society and societies in other parts of the world. So they make a decision that they are now going to broaden out from being an indigenous struggle, and they make a list of other sectors that they're particularly interested in working in, which include workers, small farmers, gay people, women, students, youth, and other sectors that are vulnerable in today's world. And they make the declaration openly that a new step forward in the indigenous struggle is only possible by joining these other groups from both the city and the countryside.
Well, that's not entirely departure for them, is it? Because I remember that famous thing that Marcos said, I am gay in San Francisco, and he had this long list of things, of his identifications with struggles elsewhere. So they've certainly not been strangers to solidarity with people outside their particular realm.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. You could never say that the Zapatista movement was contained in indigenous ghetto or just in Mexico, because it obviously had links to movements all over the world, and that has been one of its greatest strengths. I think what's different about this new stage is they're looking to join together, particularly with organized movements in these sectors, in a more systematic way than they had before, and they talk openly about trying to develop, at least within Mexico, a joint platform, which goes a step beyond formally what they've done before in terms of their relations with other groups.
One of the things about them that has made me scratch my head is that they've presented themselves as being very locally based in Chiapas, an indigenous organization. Yet their spokesperson to the world, Marcos, is obviously a very educated fellow who's read his Gramsci and Derrida and is master at handling the international media and a very clever stylist when he writes his communiques. So how have they balanced this local versus international thing in the past? And, you know, as we say, it's not entirely a departure for them to talk about solidarity without those outside, is it?
Right. Well, they've been doing it through a dual strategy. One is this process that I mentioned about consolidating their strength at their base level, which means they went through a process of trying to separate the military and the civil structures of government, building new leadership into the organization. And that has to do very specifically with their own communities within Chiapas and the territories they control, and then also with their links to other indigenous movements, and movements that, particularly indigenous, but also other movements in Mexico. On the other hand, there's been this process that has a lot to do with the media, that has a lot to do with communications, where they've reached out, they've become a symbol to like-minded organizations and individuals, and there's been kind of a snowball effect where it's not all controlled through them, it couldn't be, but there are organizations that have popped up in other parts of the world that take the essential message and have developed it and have looked to Marcos as the main person who articulates that message. So that will probably continue to be the case. And in this new stage, it's going to be interesting to see exactly how they handle it. They said very clearly that they are not going to abandon, that they're going to continue to give a lot of attention to protecting and building their base communities, and that's where they are, and that's their experience that they have to relate to the rest of the world. But they want to find out what these other groups that are vulnerable, especially under this economic model, are thinking, what they're looking at as needed to change politics within Mexico and then, by extension, within the other parts of the world as well.
I'm speaking with Laura Carlson, who is an analyst with the International Relations Center based in Mexico City and a frequent contributor to the Counterpunch website, counterpunch.org. You can find many of her articles on that website, reporting on what's going on with the Zapatistas. You mentioned earlier the good government boards. What exactly are those?
The good government boards, and the Zapatistas began the stage of consolidating self-government by forming autonomous municipalities. Municipality is like a county division, but within Mexico. They had a big base to work on when they did this because in many parts of Mexico's south, there have been forms of indigenous self-government that have been preserved and developed over the years, and that are actually in many ways outside the party system. So they worked as a basis on that, and they developed the municipalities, and then they consolidated those into good government boards that basically carry out many of the local government and regional government functions that an ordinary government would, including marriages, birth certificates, and that kind of thing. And in the areas where they are, even the members, people who are not Zapatistas, have turned to these boards as the predominant form of government in the region, and they've been able to carry on local government. So that was a big step within the organization and also as a proof that alternatives could be developed from the ground up.
To what degree has the Mexican government let them alone, or how much have they interfered?
They've attacked them a few times, but for the most part, they've left them alone. They haven't. There was one time when there was an attack, and they were destroyed and closed down. That was quite a few years ago. And in the meantime, they have basically left them alone. The good government boards and the Zapatista regions themselves made a decision not to accept government aid. So they're redlined, but actually redlined by their own choice by the government, and they've been able to fill that void through their own efforts and through international solidarity to a certain extent.
So
there's been a delicate equilibrium there.
And I've also heard that the government has poured aid into communities in the area who are not under Zapatista control. Is that true?
Yes, that's the other side of the story. They poured aid to the other communities in an attempt to try to say that you're better off if you're not a Zapatista. And they've also been aiding or at least condoning the activities of paramilitary groups. And these activities have been increasing lately. They're a very low-level and low-profile kind of a form of hostility, but they certainly exist in the area, and they have taken lives, and they form a constant kind of source of harassment that can, as we know, explode into worse incidents such as the murders in Actial, where 45 people were killed.
One of the things that's inspired people about the Zapatistas for the 11 and a half years that they've been in the national, international prominence has been the way they've shied away from trying to take state power. They've stayed in their own autonomous community, tried to carve out their own independent sphere, and have not had shown any ambitions to take over the Mexican government. What do we say at this strategy a little over a decade later? Is it working well, or is this new phase a kind of recognition of the limits of that autonomous strategy?
No, I think the new phase is an affirmation of that strategy in many ways, because they're very clearly saying rejecting electoral politics and taking over power as we know it. It's important to understand the Mexican political context here. What's happening here in Mexico is that the presidential succession, which is the main political event by far in Mexico every 6 years, has been moved up on the calendar like never before. And what I mean by that is that the jockeying for position began nearly 2 years before the elections, which are scheduled for July of 2006, and has included a lot of dirty tricks and kind of distortions to national political life than is even usual in Mexican politics. And now that's heating up, and it's preparing to take over national political life. What the Zapatistas have done is to stomp right onto that stage as a critic of the entire electoral process. So what they're saying is they've criticized all three major political parties, and that includes the center-left party, where many people who would consider themselves left or center-left have decided to support as an option at this point in Mexico's history. And what they're doing is they're coming on to that, and they're saying, we don't need to settle for the least common denominator. In those elections, the center-left candidate is mayor of Mexico City, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The federal government tried to kick him out of the elections by accusing him of violating a local law in terms of a complicated case, but they finally were forced to give up on that because of the popular support that he received. So he probably will become, it's not defined yet, the candidate of the Party of the Democratic Revolution. And the Zapatistas are saying all three of these, or rather neither one of these candidates really represents what we who consider ourselves on the left, or who consider ourselves sectors that are being hurt by this economic model, need and want in our country. So they're going out there. They're going to go around the country, a delegation of their leadership. They're going to talk to organizations, unions, farmers organizations, and they're going to say, what should we really be doing in this country besides getting involved in this election, which in the end is probably not going to make very much difference? They're not offering candidates. They will only work with organizations that are nonpartisan in this process. And they are trying to develop a national political platform, but it is not a platform to take governmental posts or to take power.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left, but what's the effect been in Mexico of some of the political developments elsewhere in Latin America? You've got some, well, Chavez is the most prominent irritant in the side of the United States and his own ruling class, but there's been a variety of left and center-left governments taking power throughout Latin America in the last couple of years. Has that had any influence in Mexico?
Yes, I think it's had a lot of influence on Mexico because it's begun to open up a door that's to alternatives. Not complete alternatives of a different model. I think most people are accepting that there has to be some form of economic integration, for example. But it's begun to make people think that it is possible to challenge the current economic model, that people are doing it, and they're doing it successfully in places like the battles against privatization in Bolivia, and in Ecuador to a certain extent, the way they've changed governments. And the Zapatistas in their declaration explicitly mention, especially Bolivia and Ecuador, because they're indigenous movements, and how they've been able to challenge head on this current economic model with some success. So they're looking and they're seeing, they say very straightforward, we're proud to be part of this and we want to contribute to it. They talk about sending corn and coffee and what they can send to Bolivia and Ecuador and to other movements throughout the world. And they're beginning to feel more connected and to specifically want to be more connected to some of these, to these movements, because what they're saying is what we have to do is everybody who is against this model and who wants to develop an alternative has to reach a point and say very clearly, we're against this and we're willing to get together and start talking concretely about what we want this alternative to look like. And that's really affected Mexican politics in a lot of ways because it's given people more room to think about that alternative building.
Well, let's hope some of it starts creeping above the Rio Grande as well. Thanks for joining us, Laura Carlson. I've been speaking with Laura Carlson, who is an analyst based in Mexico City with the International Relations Center and a frequent contributor to Counterpunch website. And you can find her articles on Mexico if you want to search for him, it's Carlson, S-E-N, C-A-R-L-S-E-N. And let's take a little break, and I'll be back to speak with Bill Fletcher.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. And before we get to Bill Fletcher, let's listen to a little bit from a group I discovered stumbling around on the web, The Fire and Reason, based here in New York City. Good, noisy, punky, arty sound. And you can find them on the web, thefireandreason.com, all one word. Let's listen to an excerpt from Her Evil.
Thank you.
And that, an excerpt from Her Evil by The Fire and Reason, a New York City-based band. And you can find their stuff on the web at thefireandreason, all one word, .com. They've also got a MySpace webpage, which you can find at the base of their homepage, thefireandreason.com. And are we waiting for Bill Fletcher to enter the room? Is that what's happening? All right, now we've got Bill Fletcher. It's a good thing, because welcome to WBAI, Bill.
I'm here.
Okay, good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So first, I was reading Nicholas Kristof's column in the New York Times the other day, and I believe the first sentence was that George Bush has done more for Africa than any president of the United States.
Yes.
And I was so stunned when I read that, I couldn't read anymore. So, but this kind of claim has been circulating, not just in Kristof's column. So, what's this all about?
Well, it's sort of like they say figures don't lie, but liars figure. It is true that, much to many people's surprise, that Bush has increased U.S. spending on Africa. That is true. What is not true, however, are the claims that, that were being made to the effect that it had been, tripled. That aid had been tripled. The administration was making that claim, and many of us, including myself, I have to confess, assumed it was the case. But Susan Rice, formerly of the State Department, wrote, now with the Brookings Institution, wrote this devastating critique that showed that not only has it not tripled, it hasn't doubled. It's increased by maybe 56%. And I think I think it's very important that we understand that this is not simply an error on the part of the administration. If this was, if you could show that the administration, normally was true to the facts and watched the numbers carefully, you could say, well, maybe somebody just hit the wrong button. But in this case, it's once again exaggerating their claims.
Well, they're pretty pretty accomplished at that. But where's the what makes up this increase in spending, and where is it going?
It's actually a variety of repackaged money. For the most part, it's either military assistance or humanitarian assistance, food aid, et cetera. It is not primarily developmental assistance, and so. One of the things that, and I'm not a defender of Blair's, please, but one of the things that Prime Minister Blair was trying to get his good ally here to recognize is that Africa needs more than simply humanitarian assistance. There needs to be developmental assistance. And this is really critical, that Africa needs the equivalent of a Marshall Plan. The post-World War II effort in Western Europe and Japan for rebuilding. This is not about charity. This is not about a handout. This is about repairing damage that has been done to the continent over hundreds of years. And it's interesting, Doug, because I've been on a number of programs the last several days, particularly on a Fox program, and I've gotten a number of letters that have called me everything but a child of God. But, I mean, they've basically said, well, you know, you're just looking for a handout. No, Africa is not looking for a handout. It's looking for the damage to be repaired. So that's infrastructure development, public health, public education, water purification. This is not about stuffing money in someone's pockets.
Well, you frequently hear the claim coming from the right that we poured trillions into Africa and things have only gotten worse. You know, to us, Africa is a continent that has been raped and pillaged for centuries. But what about this claim that we've poured all these billions and billions into Africa and there's nothing to show for it?
Well, a lot of money has been put into Africa in one sense, but the question always is, and this is what people in the United States too often want to ignore, is history. In what context? When was money put in? So, for example, money was put in to help to prop up the Portuguese colonies when they were fighting against the people that were demanding national independence. Money was put in to defend white minority regimes in what was then Rhodesia, now is Zimbabwe. and in South Africa. Money was put in to defend Cold War despots like Mobutu in the Congo, who for whom they developed a term for his regime, a kleptocracy. So, you know, the question is, yeah, of course, money was put in, but money going where? What were the terms? When the Cold War was going on, Doug, it didn't matter how corrupt these guys were as long as they were our guys. As long as they were on the U.S. side of the Cold War, they could be corrupt as all get out. But now, all of a sudden, there's a new interpretation. The other thing that I think is very important is that when you look at the kind of assistance that's been put in, again, it's not assistance that helps to build the sustainability of the continent. And I think that this is what's particularly criminal.
I just read Jeffrey Sachs' new book, The End of Poverty, and it's a strange document, and he's a strange character in many ways. He was once known as Dr. Shock, and now he's
right.
Running around the world with Bono, and many, many contradictions around Jeffrey Sachs. But he outlines a program in there based on the UN's Millennium Development Goals, which would get some really basic needs met in Africa. And you know, he adds up the money, and it's by for the United States and the other rich countries, it would be we wouldn't even notice the kinds of sums that we're talking about that would make a big difference in Africa. Have you read Sachs' stuff? And if so, what do you make of it?
I did not read the book. I read the report that I read sections of the report that was submitted to Anand. And Sachs is very interesting. He is what I would call a non-neoliberal globalizer. In other words, there are people like Stiglitz, Sachs, that have concluded that neoliberalism is not the way to save global capitalism, and that, in fact, it's going to be a train wreck for global capitalism. And Sachs has pointed out many of the atrocities, effectively, that have emerged from neoliberalism, including the situation in Africa. So he's been appealing, correctly, for massive economic assistance. And to some extent, he gets at the tip of something that is critical for the continent, which is that the demands that come from the IMF and the World Bank to restructure their economies, according to the geniuses in Geneva or Washington, are destructive. They're destructive even from the standpoint of global capital. One of the things that Sachs does not talk very much about is the accelerating global polarization of wealth. So there is obviously a growth of poverty, but there's great inequality on this planet and within the continent. And so I think that that's something that isn't given enough attention.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about the book is that he says almost nothing about Latin America. You know, the development establishment calls them middle-income countries.
Right.
He thinks that things are pretty much okay there, that once you get a leg up on, you know, the rungs of the global hierarchy, then the ladder itself is sound. It's just making those first few steps that you need some help with. And that's the kind of program he's talking about for Africa.
I think he is, in some sense, I don't know whether kind of an international neo-Keynesian. He recognizes that global capitalism is running into significant problems, and I think he sees or is hoping for an awakening or enlightenment within the centers of capital, Western capital.
He's going to have a long wait for that one.
I think so. I think so. It's like waiting for Godot.
But one of the things that struck me in the book was his language is often quite strong in his passages on colonialism in Africa. Mm-hmm. Are quite strongly worded. The things he said about the way the British ran India, very strong stuff. Actually quotes Mike Davis approvingly in there.
Oh, yeah.
And even his comments on post-World War II history about our support for the kleptocrats and the thugs that we supported in the struggle against communism, all that pretty strong language. So it's he's not just a standard issue economist.
I agree.
Stuff.
I think, you know, you would know more than better than me. I definitely get this feeling that there is this reaction to neoliberal globalization that's coming from some very prominent forces that really do worry. They're not people that are looking for any sort of massive redistribution of wealth or social transformation. They really are looking at the interests of the preservation of capitalism, but and feel that neoliberalism is in acting against the interests of the long-term preservation of capitalism. And I would put Sachs in that, and I think that his critiques can be very, very useful and give many of us good ammunition, but I think we have to understand what's motivating them.
I'm speaking with Bill Fletcher, the director of TransAfrica, based in Washington, D.C. I've also seen some criticisms coming from people on the probably far left in Africa, who reject all this talk of aid and say it's patronizing. It's just imperialism in a new form. What do you say to that kind of critique?
I understand the critique. I think that we have to sort of dissect it. That aid that comes with the traditional conditionalities undermines the ability of governments and peoples to set their own direction. So, for example, if you're sending economic assistance to the Cameroon, and you're saying that we will send you $200 million of aid, but with that $200 million, you have to spend $150 of it buying products from the United States, then this is absurd. Or if you're saying that the aid will only arrive if there is a privatization process that takes place, then it forces these countries to surrender their sovereignty. This is part of my criticism of what unfolded around the recent debt cancellation. I contrast that, however, with the notion of economic assistance a la Marshall Plan. I'm using that term very loosely, but massive economic development assistance aimed at infrastructure building as repairing damage, that is, reparations, repairing the damage that has been done. The only way that that can happen, though, is if there's a partnership that exists. That is, if the Western countries are not simply dumping things on the Global South, not simply telling the Global South, this is the way you have to use this, but in fact working out arrangements that the assistance furthers the objectives of these countries. So in that sense, I think it is it's not the writing off all aid, it seems to me to be overreaching.
You mentioned the debt relief package. I think there's a story I saw in the Financial Times the other day that the increase in oil prices is going to cost Africa about $10 billion a year. They're getting about $1 billion a year in debt relief. So the debt relief is pretty much all gone already.
Well, I mean, it really does scare me. I mean, I was thinking about the origin of this, of the current debt crisis, goes back to the mid-70s and the first oil shock. And the impact that that had, when I was in this debate with Fox, this right winger was saying that the living standards of African countries have consistently declined since colonialism. And I said, no, that's factually an error, that the living standards increased into the mid-70s. And it was at the time of the oil shock that you then start to see this decline, and the oil shock then merges with the introduction of neoliberalism. My worry is that the steps that a number of countries have taken towards recovering from the damage that had been done over the last 20 years will be further hurt by this. And it raises some very powerful questions that have to be asked about South-South cooperation on oil, something that many African countries were asking in the mid-1970s. When they supported the oil embargo that the Arab nations carried out after the Yom Kippur War, they were basically saying, okay, we will support you, but we need some relief. And unfortunately, many of these reactionary leaders in oil-producing countries just ignored them. So I think that there's big questions that Africa needs to look at continent-wide in terms of oil-producing regions, you know, in Africa, such as the Gulf of Guinea, southern Sudan. What can be done to produce oil that can be used in the continent to further economic development of the continent?
And, of course, Nigeria is a major oil exporter, and that country is in pretty dire shape. So
that's right. I mean, the irony is that these countries that are filthy rich in terms of natural resources, oil, et cetera, have incredible wealth polarizations and other problems. Angola is another case in point, and Equatorial Guinea. There are these massive oil reserves in the Gulf of Guinea that the United States knows and understands, and that's one of the reasons that they're contemplating this whole issue of troop redeployment from Europe into Africa to secure these oil areas. Well, what are African countries doing to secure these oil reserves for their own self-determined development?
Well, it's much more important to feed American SUVs than it is to bring oil to Africa, apparently.
Tell me about it.
You mentioned several times the idea of a Marshall Plan. Marshall Plan politically was motivated by no small amount of self-interest. There was an attempt to get the world trading system going again after World War II. We had to get dollars over to Europe. We had to reconstruct the world to the European economies. So even though it's presented as a great act of charity, in fact, it was a classic case of enlightened self-interest, let's call it.
Right.
What is the political selling point to any kind of aid to Africa? You know, it's not a very popular thing in most American circles. How can you convince Americans to change their mind?
Well, I mean, this is a $64,000 question, or maybe even raise the price tag on that. First, let me just go back to the Marshall Plan. I think in some ways I would go further. The Marshall Plan was in direct response to revolutionary movements that existed in Europe and in Japan after World War II, and the United States was deeply worried, not about a Soviet invasion, but that these countries would undergo dramatic transformations. And in that, absolutely, the Marshall Plan was enlightened self-interest. The difficulty we have now in this post-Cold War world is essentially U.S. ruling circles aren't really worried about any countries leaving their orbit except in Latin America, and to some extent in certain parts of Asia, to the extent to which countries are talking about the development of regional blocs. This is what I'm hoping gets raised much more seriously within Africa, that Africa needs both continental unity as well as subcontinental regional development that's inwardly focused. Now, why should the United States support this? I guess that there's a couple of different answers. On one level, I would say that, you know, over and again, we hear this idiocy around so-called personal responsibility. Individuals need to take care of themselves as if there's no larger society and social system in which we're operating. Well, let's talk about collective responsibility. The United States is deeply implicated in the state that Africa has found itself, either through things that we were talking about before, supporting colonial wars, supporting white minority regimes, the role in the Cold War, or the blatant destruction of countries like the Congo and Angola. So there is a moral/political imperative that says that when you do harm, you must repair. You must be held accountable for repairing. And that means that there needs to be a political movement in the United States. I don't ever expect, Doug, that George Bush is going to wake up and say, you know what, the U.S. has really screwed Africa, so what we're going to do is assume responsibility. That's not going to happen short of a political movement in the United States that, in fact, demands change, and much as we've done in the past with other movements. The people like Sachs, Jeffrey Sachs, and others, they can be appealed to on the basis that the further erosion of Africa could also have implications for the rest of global capitalism. Therefore, from their own narrow self-interest, putting development assistance into Africa, building and strengthening the infrastructure in Africa, may be a means of putting off some sort of collapse or a devastating economic situation. The to put it in more positive terms for them, they could actually be building great trading partners if Africa's infrastructure and underdevelopment is addressed. So there are a variety of arguments that can be made. Ultimately, though, I'm one of those, whether you want to call cynics or skeptics, that basically believes that power concedes nothing without demand and that there will be no change unless we're able to put people in the streets to make it very clear that there must be a different Africa policy.
And we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I want to shift gears in the last 2 minutes and ask you. I saw a memo or a speech that you gave recently about plans to split up the AFL-CIO, led by Andy Stern. You spent some,
yes,
many years in the organized labor before you went over to TransAfrica. I really do only have 2 minutes, but your critique is that it's too much organization and not enough politics, basically. Could you give us a two-minute
version of that
critique?
Yeah, basically that there is a crisis, very obviously, that there has needed for years to have been a debate about the future of organized labor, and that debate has been suppressed. That discussing structure when we're not discussing strategy, mission, objectives, a vision, ends up putting the cart way before the horse and ends up creating a situation where we are making a series of assumptions about what we need without talking about what do workers in the United States need, without simple answers like they need unions. Well, they need unions, but we need power. How do we get it? At what level are we actually talking about? And so in the absence of this, the debate has become extremely personal and in many ways not particularly productive or enlightening, and the results being that very few regular people at the base are rallying to either side.
It does seem like Stern and the people in the SEIU who are talking about pulling out of the AFL-CIO really are just talking about organizational matters, right? There is no political agenda or vision that I can see. Am I missing something, or is it just
no?
Not there?
I think that there's elements of a vision, but militancy, and even a commitment to organizing, that's not a vision in and of itself. At least it's never been a successful one in the United States. The CIO vision was more than just organizing the unorganized. The vision of the Wobblies was more than just organizing the unorganized. There was this whole notion of fighting a battle for social and political, economic, political and economic justice. There was a notion in the 30s of fighting against fascism, of fighting for an expansion of democracy. There was a notion in the Wobblies of a different kind of U.S. society. Unfortunately, at best, you get these platitudes.
Well, that's not what we get from you, Bill Fletcher. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Bill Fletcher, Director of TransAfrica, based in Washington, D.C., and also commenting on what's been going on with the organized labor movement in the United States. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And let's go out with another selection from the band The Fire and Reason. Again, you can find their stuff, three songs downloadable from their website, thefireandreason.com. This is Japanese Love Kill. Until next week, goodbye.